As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Harm Badholz, who joins us now in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. He's the chief U.S. economist at the UniCredit Group. Great to have you here with us. Let's start with what I just mentioned there. There had been such optimism and enthusiasm for stuff getting done in Washington, D.C. It seems like we've reached a pivot point here where there's some realism, some skepticism, perhaps, that this isn't going to happen, at least not as fast as many thought.
Yeah, maybe it's more realism right now. I still think that what the market's really waiting for is a big tax cut. So, I mean, to be honest, the market does not care so much about the healthcare bill as many Americans. For global financial markets, if it's Obamacare or any other healthcare system, they couldn't care less. But they know that the new administration basically set up the sequencing. They first want to repeal or replace Obamacare and then continue with the tax cuts. So, of course, there's a ripple effect. If the healthcare bill does not pass Congress, then that may have negative consequences as well for the timeline of the tax cuts. And so from that perspective, there is more realism. They are looking at it more in a bit more skeptical way and wonder, I don't think whether we do get a tax cut at all, but when.
Yeah, there's a fascinating piece on the Bloomberg yesterday about the order of operations here. There are political motivations for doing the Affordable Care Act repeal first, but it sort of lays the groundwork for tax reform. There are tax cuts in this particular bill, and I think there's a lot of political concern that if this couldn't get through, that would mean the rest of the president's agenda would have trouble as well. As you look at this process play out, what does it tell you about the prospects for tax reform?
Well, first of all, it shows the disconnect, and I think globally investors have to understand the different dynamics of U.S. politics compared to what global investors look at.
Yes.
I mean, we have seen during the election that there are topics much more important for U.S. voters than they may be for international investors. And as I said, for many Republican voters, for almost all Republican voters, this Obamacare has been really a red flag and they want to get rid of it. And that's why it is politically important, I think, for the Republican Party to deliver because, I mean, they have been, if you want, benefiting over the last now 6 years, I think, since the 2010 midterm election from Obamacare. And have been able to rally against this, gain voters. So that's why it is so important for them to do it first, to fulfill the pledge to their voters. Plus, as you correctly pointed out, Obamacare has some tax relevant provisions. So in other words, if the Republican administration would get the tax reform through, simplify the tax code, and then a couple of months later, all of a sudden the Cadillac tax and other things kick in, you all of a sudden make it more complicated. So I think, and now they have said they want to do it first, they need to deliver because they can't say, we changed the plan right now, they can't do it. So they have to come up with healthcare.
And you just wrote a great piece on manufacturing, really, really smart with a lot of theory to it. Let me cut to the chase. Is it finally time for a national policy on manufacturing? If we're going to develop a little Switzerland or a big Switzerland with all the politics and Mr. Trump going out and saying, I'm creating jobs, baloney, do we finally need a labor policy to boost manufacturing jobs?
First of all, do you mean big Switzerland? Is that Germany?
Yeah, that would be, excuse me.
Sorry.
Excuse me. Oh, am I in trouble? Why you help me here? Get me out of this quickly.
No, I completely agree. But I wouldn't necessarily call it manufacturing policy because, you know, I think what the U.S. really needs is a system of getting the education house in order. I always come back to that. There's, of course, a relative small group of the population being extremely well educated. But if you look at the broad masses, there is some room for improvement, to say politely. So I think that is where the government needs to step in. And then you can also think about the system of people may leave after middle school. That is very often happens in Germany. And then you go to a company, do an apprenticeship, and then you continue going to school, but you learn only the stuff that you need for your job. You get specialized experts for your field. And I think that is an important reason why countries like Switzerland or Germany or some other countries are doing so extremely well. They produce high quality stuff, and that justifies them to get relatively high prices in the global market. Because let's face it, the U.S. is an expensive country with a high GDP per capita. So the U.S. will never compete on a price basis with many of the other global players. It has to produce high quality stuff. And that for that, you need a very well educated workforce.
Why haven't we seen the apprenticeship model here? That was certainly something that was discussed at the White House when Chancellor Merkel was there.
We saw it with the president, excuse me.
Oh, you think? I spoke with Marc Benioff of Salesforce, who was at a meeting at the White House before that joint press conference with those two leaders. It's something that he champions. He thinks is happening within his company and should happen more. Why is it not a phenomenon that's caught on here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I read a little bit about it as well. Some people say, well, that's because the labor market is not as strict as in Germany. In Germany, you basically have the system. If you do an apprenticeship in a company, you stay there until you retire. So kind of it's an investment from the company side initially, and it pays back for the company over the next 3 or 4 decades. In the U.S., obviously, the system is very different. You are very often employed at will. So if you do that apprenticeship, the company invests in you, and then you get a better offer from somebody else, you leave. So maybe the incentive for companies to offer something like that on an individual basis, if you want, is very limited. For that reason, we would need something institutionalized so that everybody participates. So then, you know, then the incentive for one company is as big as for the other one. Because you have fluctuations, but maybe at the end of the day, you still end up with well-trained people. So it has to come from the top.
Tom asks about policy. We hear so little about automation, and you have a startling chart in your most recent chart book looking at divided by education, level of education. Mm-hmm. If you're at a lower level of education, if you've been in secondary school, say, and that's it, something like a 49% chance that your job could be automated. Why are we not hearing more about that, and how real is that threat?
I think we are hearing indirectly because I wrote last year a piece about robots because I wanted to educate myself. So that was part of the results. And I think we are hearing about this, people losing the jobs, the losers of technological progress by looking at the polls. I think Mr. Trump, Brexit, all the polls that we see in Europe is the result of some of these losers of globalization and technological progress having been left on their own for too long. I think we are seeing it, and the chart that you quoted is actually from an OECD study, and I was just happy to use the numbers.
We do that here.
Yes, of course. No, I mean, and that suggests that it will continue. Yeah. So established parties or politicians have to find a way to deal with that because it is getting worse, if you want, before it gets better in terms of inequality. So technological progress is a good thing, but it produces winners and losers, and we have to take care of the losers.
Help me here, and this is way off script, but I'll go with it, Harm. Help me here with Big Switzerland. What did you detect within the body language of Chancellor Merkel's visit to President Trump? I mean, there was, I'm sorry, for Americans, it was lost in translation. There were little subtleties and nuances we didn't pick up. What did you pick up?
No, I mean, I think it is very hard, and I think that's Chancellor Merkel's big strength to have that, how can I call it, poker face maybe all the time. She does not or barely signal anything if she is in these meetings. I think her strength is she's very well prepared, extremely well prepared. She knows exactly where she can give something and where she doesn't want to move. It was interesting that she did, I mean, for her, given that it was Merkel, her initial statement that it's better to talk to each other than about each other, I mean, that was more clear than anything I heard from Merkel. If you're used to other rhetoric, then you may not notice that. But for Merkel, that was a very strong statement and lashing out at Trump, honestly. But thereafter, she gave something back saying, yeah, we have to increase our defense spending and all that stuff. So she was willing to give that to the president. But I'm pretty sure, you know, the big criticism we have heard from Peter Navarro and others that Germany has to move to change the trade surplus, that's not going to happen.
Okay. I would kill for you to write again on oil. I don't know. I don't want to tell. I don't want to be Erik Nielsen and tell you what to do. But I would kill to get Harm Bondels from oil in the next 6 weeks. He is with UniCredit. Terrific research. Again, we protect the copyright of all our guests, even Michael Barr. We do not send out Michael Barr's news reports.
All
as
those
well.
Batman comics those are, that I wrote.
Those are highly, highly protected. Harm Bondels, thank you so much. I've been waiting for this interview because April 6, 7, mark your calendars. What are we calling Mar-a-Lago?
We've got to have a good
the golf house?
I don't think they can golf. I think in light of what the president,
the winter
Chinese
White
president
house?
Has said about golf.
Why
I think that's
the winter White House? Don Strezheim, will you be there at Mar-a-Lago golfing with the president and the leadership of China?
I won't be there. President Xi is not a golfer, so I think it'll just
what
be.
What are they going to do?
I don't know. They're going to have a cordial time, pleasant, but no progress. And quite frankly, the problem is that President Xi has no idea what President Trump thinks, nor does anybody else.
One of my young troops, Wai Yu Yen, just sent me a GIF, whatever you call it, a little video of Chancellor Merkel looking at the president during the press conference, and it was suitably hilarious.
Subtle
We're not
reaction.
Getting the same look from the leadership of China. Let me properly introduce you, Donald Strezheim, folks, with decades, Evercore ISI, on his China. What do they think of this president?
They are, I'm pretty confident, astonished, as I think many people are. We have a president now who is behaving differently than any president that I can remember. I think, quite frankly, he has some sound bites in mind, but not many principled views. And without an anchor of that sort, you get this flopping around, this distraction, lack of focus. And I think the healthcare thing is just one simple symptom of that.
We had the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in Beijing in the Hall of the People meeting with the president a couple of days ago, laying the groundwork, I gather, for that visit to Florida. What did you hear from him that might give you some sense of what's going to be discussed, what might come out of that meeting in Florida?
Well, I think he focused primarily on areas of agreement. Mm. And that's what you would expect. We know there are a variety of conflicts on the trade side, on the investment side, North Korea, and so on and on. So focus on what the two of you can agree to and kind of kick the can down the road and talk more later about what they don't agree on.
Got to ask you about what's happening with the PBOC, the third day here of the PBOC injecting more money into the financial space in China. What's going on there? How anomalous is it, and how concerned should investors be by what's happening?
You shouldn't be concerned at all.
Okay.
This is PBOC has more difficulty than many central banks gauging liquidity demands in the very short run. These episodes come and go, as this one will. China is in Draghi mode, whatever it takes for a good economy in 2017. This is their selection year after last year was our election year. So things will be fine.
You know, we watched as Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin went to Berlin and then to Baden-Baden, and he was asked about labeling China a currency manipulator. He said that's something that will be discussed at these sort of semi-annual reviews within the Treasury Department. Give us your sense of the timetable for looking at the Chinese currency, what you expect to hear from the Treasury Department.
A Treasury seemingly is going to go back to the typical schedule of April and October reviews, in which they look at various countries and decide if that country is or is not a currency manipulator in their view. I think they will again conclude that they are not. I think Washington is coming to the view that they have precious little leverage over China on trade and on the currency. And so the surprise will be how little they do this year, not how much.
I saw an article yesterday on the cost to live in Asia, Singapore leading the way for idiocy. Is China pricing their cities out of competition with how much it costs to live there?
No, I don't think so. Okay. It has become a lot more pricey, but the people still want to live in the tier one cities.
Yeah,
and just like they do in this country, Boston and New York and L.A. and San Francisco are extraordinarily pricey, but that's not killing Houston and Chicago.
Have fun playing golf in Florida, April 6th and 7th. Don Strassheim is with Evercore ISI.
Good luck with the bracket as well. Purdue is still in Tom's bracket.
We're in this.
We're there. So go. Far. Boiler up. Boiler up with Don Strassheim. Purdue, North Carolina. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
David Gura with Tom Keene in New York. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. If J. Alfred Prufrock measured his life with coffee spoons, we increasingly measure ours with presidential tweets. Donald Trump tweeting moments ago, big day for healthcare, working hard. And we'll use that as a peg for our next conversation here with Zeke Emanuel, chair of the Medical Ethics and Health Policy Department at the University of Pennsylvania, who had an audience with the president just a couple of days ago at the White House. Great of you to join us. Thanks very much for being here. And without divulging too much detail of your conversation with the president, what did you want to convey to him about health reform generally? What's working and what's not?
Well, I wanted to convey to him that, as I've said in lots of other public venues, including the New York Times and Fox, that I think the Paul Ryan bill in the House is not a good bill, and he should not support it. It does not realize his goals. His goals are, as he has said many times, he wants to, get coverage for all Americans, and he has not said access, he has said coverage. And second of all, he wants to bring health care costs down so that health care is affordable to more Americans. He also says that he would like to negotiate drug prices because drug prices are too high. This bill does none of those things. As we all know, according to the CBO, it will dramatically increase the number of uninsured. Maybe 24 million isn't exactly the right number, but it's certainly going to be tens of millions of people are going to lose insurance. And we've already heard from a number of insurers that if this bill passes, they are jacking up their premiums. And even the CBO said that by 2020, premiums will go up 20%. Then they'll decline only for young people and increase for older people. This is not a bill that realizes the president's objectives or the objectives that all of us should have for the healthcare system.
Let me talk about those objectives a little bit more here. I'm curious why, when we talk about healthcare policy, it happens to happen in these very time-limited portions. In other words, it's so important, yet we see this sort of being moved through Congress rather quickly. We saw the same thing with the Affordable Care Act before.
Wait
a sec.
Don't
okay.
Go there. No, you're misrepresenting history, and I cannot let that go on.
Well, it was a nine-month process.
It was, excuse me, we started on January 20th, and we passed it on March 23rd. That's a 14-month process, and this is less than 60 days. That it was not equivalent. When we introduced the bill in the House, when Nancy Pelosi introduced the bill in the House, it was 116 days before it was voted on. Here, there's 16 days. These are not equivalent. The Republicans are not doing what the Democrats did. We tried to negotiate. We had the Gang of Four, the Gang of Six, the Gang of Eight to try to negotiate with Republicans. They haven't even called a single Democrat, to the best of anyone's knowledge, to talk. Okay, so this is not equivalent. This is much worse. All right, I'm not going to have the equivalency. It's just like the Democrats. That's false.
You hear from the House Speaker, however, that this has been something on which this party has run for cycle after cycle after cycle. He's rejecting the comment that you just made there, that this is something big force through.
No, he's run on repeal and replace, and as many of us have noted multiple times, he's never had a replacement bill. He's never articulated something until now when he had to go out there. The reason he never articulated something is because he got a terrible CBO score. If he had put in a bill before, he would never. I mean, this score is devastatingly bad.
I didn't mean for the question to be offensive. What I intended to get to here is it doesn't seem like it's very dialogical. It's hard for politicians to talk about what, in fact, is wrong with health care in this country and to work it out. Why is that the case? In other words, why does it have to come to sort of a crisis point like this?
Wait a second. I'm the policy brother. I'm the guy who thinks of what is the best policy for the health care system. And as I have said multiple times, I do believe there's a bipartisan approach. I don't think the alternative is keep the ACA, do Representative Rand Paul's approach of just repeal and no replacement, or your only other approach is Paul Ryan. There's other approaches, including a bipartisan approach that begins where there's overlap. And I don't know why politicians can't seem to come to rational, reasonable agreement. You know, you'd have to ask my political brother. He understands those things better than I do.
He's a little occupied. Zeke, we're going to continue. I want to do the next block of you as well. But let me ask you this. Mark Meadows got chewed out yesterday by the president of the United States. He's from Western North Carolina. If I go down to the former St. Joseph's Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, or I go to your Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, let me ask the question of the same doctors at St. Joseph's and the doctors at Beth Israel. What's in this for the doctors? You're a doctor. You're like a real doctor. What do the doctors want out of this Donnybrook in Washington?
Let me emphasize 3 points. First, the AMA has come out against this bill. Doctors are I think very strongly against this bill, and the American public ought to know this. Doctors were very nervous about the Affordable Care Act. They didn't understand it initially. It was complicated. I run a panel every year at Wharton, where I teach for my students. I bring in doctors. And, you know, the first few years after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, doctors were like kind of negative. I've got to do this electronic health records. I don't know what the payment system is going to be. Now they love it. The last few years I've been doing it, doctors are so much better.
Let's do this, Zeke. We're going to come back. Zeke Emanuel with us, fired up about what we're seeing. And, of course, the drama that we'll see today and into tomorrow in Washington. Stay in touch with Bloomberg News Washington, our good Kevin Cirilli, as well, about what we'll see forward on health care.
Zeke Emanuel, university professor at Penn, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, an expert on health policy. We're having a spirited discussion about what's going on Capitol Hill this week. Let me ask you about what the insurance companies are saying. We've watched in these weeks and months leading up to today a number of insurers pulling out of markets. We saw that with Aetna and others. They say it's not competitive for them to be there. Certainly this is something that at face is worrisome to consumers. What's the solution here? How do you get insurers to get back into those markets?
Right. You have to have consumers in the market. You have to have protect them against the uncertainties of this market. You know, any new health insurance market is a problem because you don't know who's going to come in. You don't know what their health utilization is going to be. Pricing the product in that situation is uncertain. That's why we built in risk corridors, reinsurance in case people are more expensive than they anticipated. Those were part of the rules of the game going forward. We adopted them from the Republicans who introduced it in Medicare Part D. And then Marco Rubio changed the rules. He pulled those things out and upset the insurance marketplace. We need to put them back in. And by the way, Representative or Speaker Ryan's bill has $100 billion in a stability fund for exactly this kind of thing, reinsurance, making sure that people are high cost, do not affect the insurer's bottom line. That kind of thing would definitely stabilize the market, and we believe in that. We also think you need to probably adjust the subsidies, my favorite approach is forget the mandate, forget the penalty if you're not continuously insured. Let's go to auto enrollment for people like we have in Medicare Part A. I think there are those kind of changes that'll, you know, could substantially get them stabilize the market. But we should also note that the CBO, when they scored the bill, said, look, the marketplaces are stable. They're going to continue. They're not going under. They're not collapsing. That claim by Representative Ryan and others that the marketplaces are collapsing, simply false. Okay? Fake news again.
Last question here. We heard from the president in that speech before a joint session of Congress. He wants to have insurance available across state lines. I imagine that might be something he brought up with you when you visited with him at the White House. What's the rationale for that? How likely is that to happen, and what difference could that make?
Well, let's inform your listeners. Three states already have allow insurers to come across state lines, Maine and Georgia, and I forget the third one. Okay. Not one single insurer has taken it up, even though it's legal in those states. And the reason is it's complex. Setting up a network is complex. Unless you have enough people willing to buy, it's too expensive to set up a network and other things. So it's not, and even if it got set up, most economists estimate it would hardly affect premiums at all. So unless you're going to have a race to the bottom where insurers can come in and basically offer these horrible medical insurance plans that are very skinny, it's not really going to do a big job. And then if it does a big job, it would do a big job by depriving people of coverage for basic items. So it's not a solution. I mean, I'm not opposed to it, but it's hardly the core of a solution.
Zeke, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to speaking to you again. He's a laureate from Yale, Robert Shiller. Bob, good morning. We'll make it quick today. You wrote a book called Finance and the Good Society. Where did the good society go?
Well, we've got the tough businessman that we wanted, I guess. People want someone who can say no, who can say you're fired. They got him. It's a whole different view. Well, it is a whole different. My book, Finance and the Good Society, was about the business world and what it can do for society. Ultimately, we owe much or most of our well-being to business. And so Trump is on that wavelength, on the wavelengths in that book.
What's your sense of what's happening in Washington today? There was such enthusiasm, such optimism that so much was going to get done so quickly. We're seeing that not happen. Give us your take on what's going on there. Is this anything different? Are we seeing anything new out of Washington, D.C. today?
Well, unfortunately, one of my gripes about Donald Trump is that he oversimplifies or implies that it's easy to fix these problems. We have a healthcare system that I applaud. It has some chinks in it. We can work on improving it, but the rhetoric is as if the people who framed it were just stupid or incompetent or biased. That isn't what happened. We have a system that could be improved, but it's just not going to be so easy to fix it.
Let me ask you lastly here just about growth and the degree to which all of this could affect growth, that being healthcare reform or tax reform or indeed an infrastructure package if we were to get that. How optimistic are you that we can see the growth trajectory change in this country?
Well, you know, we measure growth by something called gross domestic product. I do feel that loosening regulations will tend to boost that. But the problem is that gross domestic product isn't the best possible measure of well-being for the nation. So things like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which were created by Dodd-Frank, might be eliminated or handicapped. That would actually help GDP, but I think it would hurt the overall welfare.
Professor Shiller, thank you so much. Too short a visit today. We'll do it again for a much longer time. He is with Yale University. And, of course, a classic book on the exuberance of our markets. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.